the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Lara Marlow joins us from Paris, and today in the Irish Times you wrote about the 16 days, gut-wrenching days you call them, culminating in the White House assault and Vladimir Zelensky. But just remind us, please, of many of the things that happened in those 16 days which perhaps made what happened last Friday almost inevitable.
It started on February 12th. When Donald Trump announced that he'd spent 90 minutes on the telephone with his friend Vladimir Putin. And the same day we learned that the U.S. Defense Secretary in Brussels had said that Ukraine will never be allowed to join NATO. And as you remember, twice in 2008 and again in 2023, the U.S. and other NATO members promised that Ukraine would eventually be allowed to join the organization. And Zelensky wanted to join NATO as the, what he saw as a guarantee that Russia wouldn't intervene in Ukraine again. Then the Americans went ahead and organized a meeting with Russians at Secretary of State and Foreign Minister level in Saudi Arabia the following Monday. There were no Europeans invited, no Ukrainians invited. And then Donald Trump called Zelensky a dictator and claimed that Ukraine started the war. So it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And at the Munich Security Conference, Vice President J.D. Vance blamed everything that's wrong in the world on liberal Democrats. He said it was all of the instability was because of them trying to suppress freedom of speech, and that it was a greater threat than Russian aggression. And then on the 24th of February, the third anniversary of the full-scale Russian invasion, at the United Nations, the U.S. refused to endorse a General Assembly resolution naming Russia as the aggressor in the war in Ukraine. And they instead did a very short three-sentence resolution in the Security Council, which just called for peace in Ukraine but did not say who started the war. And that was voted in for the first time ever, as far as I know, the U.S. voted with North Korea, China, and Russia. And the French and British abstain, so the U.S. is voting against its putative allies. So, as you say, Matt, this was all build up for what happened on Friday.
Nick Ferrari, you were with us late last week talking about what we believed at that stage was Keir Starmer's successful visit to the Oval Office, in that he had managed to charm Donald Trump. But it would appear that the benefits of that trip didn't last very long, did it?
No, they didn't, because it was completely overturned by what we witnessed, the shocking scenes, really, with both Donald Trump and his vice president, J.D. Vance, going after Volodymyr Zelensky. But in politics, everything's an opportunity. And I have to say that over here in the United Kingdom, I'm watching the Prime Minister speaking in the House of Commons now. He's talked about putting together a coalition of the willing. And much as you and I discussed that, the reviews were in last week for his trip to Washington, the reviews are in his weekend conference where he gathered other world leaders, and we're talking about some hefty world leaders as well. You've got France, you've got Canada, you've got the European Union and others, and which they said, we are at a crossroads, and everybody seems to have universal acclaim for what Sir Keir is doing. He is, if you like, the link man. If this was rugby, he's the midfield. He's the one who's keeping the backs and the forwards together. He is the one that will provide the link between Europe, between the United States, and, of course, all importantly, President Zelensky. And what a difference the width of the Atlantic makes, because when Zelensky arrived here in the United Kingdom, not only was he greeted by the Prime Minister, the King, King Charles, and bear in mind he has a pretty tight schedule, he made a point of making sure that Zelensky was there and posing for photographs with his arm, with the King's arm around Zelensky. The mood music and the body language could not be more starkly opposed to what we witnessed in Washington, Matt.
Let's hear a little bit of what Keir Starmer has said on his four-point plan for Ukraine.
We will go further to develop a coalition of the willing to defend a deal in Ukraine and to guarantee the peace. The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air, together with others. Europe must do the heavy lifting. But to support peace in our continent and to succeed, This effort must have strong US backing.
Why, Nick Ferrari, is Keir Starmer so strong in this issue? Why is he so determined to take the lead?
Because I think this I think this in a sense relieves him of some pretty bad problems on his domestic agenda. And I think because, and put all the political side to one's, put all the political aspects to one side of Brexit, you know what Donald Trump thinks of the European Union. Pardon my language, I remind your listeners, it was set up to screw America, the president's words, not mine. So this is a possible benefit of Brexit politically, in that Sir Keir Starmer can be the person who's in the middle. He's obviously, we are next to Europe, we are allied with Europe, we are geographically close to Europe, but we are not within the European Union. We like to think we have this special relationship with the United States. I think France thinks they have a special relationship with the United States. I think many countries, but whichever way you cut it, they had a very positive meeting, Sir Keir Starmer and the American president last week, certainly by terms of reference to what we saw on Friday. So that's why it's playing to Sir Keir's strength. And I have to say, I'm watching Matt, Conservatives now standing up and praising James Cleverly. I remind your listeners, he was the Conservative Foreign Secretary and indeed Home Secretary. He was a contender to run the party. He's just said, I find myself in a very difficult position. I'm agreeing with everything that Sir Keir Starmer is saying.
And then what about Nigel Farage, the so-called coming force in British politics, who you had on your radio show this morning for a lengthy interview, in which he seemed to be almost taking the Russian side in his desire to praise Trump?
Getting a lot of criticism in the House for that interview, actually, Matt, about half an hour ago, somebody going after him over that. What did Zelensky get wrong? He didn't wear a suit and he didn't have smart shoes. And to quote Nigel Farage, Donald Trump is, quote, very old-fashioned about this sort of thing. He should have looked smart. I reminded him that Winston Churchill once went and met with an American president wearing what we call a siren suit, or like a, almost like dungarees in ready for battle in World War II. To which Mr. Farage says, oh, yes, but he wasn't meeting President Trump. So, yeah, pretty much full support, criticism of Zelensky, and criticism for the way that he handled the meeting prior to it sitting in front of the fireplace. So he's under a lot of attack for taking the Russian side.
Yeah, and of course we do remember Elon Musk only weeks ago in the Oval Office with his four-year-old child, neither of whom were wearing suits. I'll let you go, Nick Ferrari. Thank you very much for joining us. Lara Marlow, what's the view in France about the lead or the role that the United Kingdom is taking as being very much an ally of the main European Union countries in all of this?
Well, I think the French mainly see Emmanuel Macron's role, which they approve of him. You know, Macron made it to Washington before Keir Starmer. He was there on Monday, and Starmer was there on Thursday, if my memory is correct. But there's also a sense that Starmer and Macron are not totally in tune with each other. Macron now is proposing a one-month ceasefire. He says that he wants all fighting in the air, at sea, and against energy installations to stop. But he says it can't stop on the ground because the line of contact is 1,200 kilometers wrong and so on. And Keir Starmer is known to object to this Macron plan, which Macron is very impulsive, and he apparently threw this out late yesterday, and nobody really disagreed, but nobody approved of it either. And then he brought it up again in the Figaro. And Macron also has to deal with big domestic problems. His government is very unstable. He had four prime ministers last year. So like Starmer, this, I think, you know, starring on the international stage is a way to forget his domestic problems. He's got more resistance to what he's trying to do than I think Keir Starmer does, because Macron has the far left and the far right, who are both pro-Putin, although the far left is not pro-Trump, but Marine Le Pen's national rally is turning pro-Trump again. So we'll see. I mean, Macron is very good at this sort of international initiative thing. He also, people are reminding me that at the Sorbonne, at the beginning of his first term, he made a big speech on Europe. He talked about European defense. And there's a certain satisfaction in France that they have for decades been saying we must be independent of the Americans, we must develop a European defense, and nobody else ever wanted it before. And now you have Frederick Merz, who's going to be the next German chancellor, and Keir Starmer saying this. I think Starmer is probably the closest just by tradition to Washington. The British really do have this special relationship, although Giorgia Meloni now is trying to compete with that because she sort of feels like she is Trump's favorite, and she's expressing reservations about what Starmer and Macron are trying to do. It really is a Franco-British initiative. So one can see all the cracks in it already. At the same time, I think there's a lot of relief that these two leaders, Macron and Starmer, are trying to do something and that they are both willing to send boots on the ground to Ukraine. But then it's not really clear what the soldiers, the British and French soldiers, will do in Ukraine. Starmer said other countries were also willing, but he didn't say which ones. Are they some kind of tripwire force? They're certainly not going to send enough to patrol the whole 1,200-kilometer conflict line. So there's a lot of very, very unclear approximations and guessing, and then the whole question of the United States, because to my mind, after seeing that scene in the Oval Office on Friday, I don't see how they can work with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is clearly in Vladimir Putin's pocket. He's Putin's mouthpiece, and he has espoused every war aim of Russia just about. So can he really be trusted to negotiate an equitable...
Well, that's something that we will be discussing after 5 o'clock. Laura Marlowe, thank you very much for joining us from Paris.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
We will have Marion McKeown and Cal Thomas and Dr. Edward Burke, but I want to start with the Minister of State of the Department of Defence, who has responsibility for European Affairs and Defence, Thomas Byrne. Thank you for joining us. Can you tell us, please, Minister, first, how much additional money is our government going to give Ukraine as a result of what's been happening in recent weeks?
Look, I think that will take a cabinet decision. I know we want to give them significant assistance, and that can be done through, one, providing military equipment of non-lethal means, but also, two, some practical assistance for communities. I mean, one of the things we've done with Lithuania is put bomb shelters in schools, and that's really important. It's really tragic that that's what has to happen. But that type of money that we'll be spending on, I suppose we want to give a significant contribution because that's necessary. Many of our Eastern European counterparts are given significant militarily lethal support. And I think that we have to be in that space as well of giving support to Ukraine, because we know that this is really, really important for the security of the entire European continent. And we are part of that, notwithstanding that we're on the far west side of it.
But there have been reports that we could commit up to €400 million by the time May comes around.
Well, look, those types of figures have been bandied about, but I mean, there's significant assistance already given, and there will be more support given as well. So let's see what the government decides to do. And I think that the money that we will give Ukraine will be very useful, extremely necessary, and will in no way impinge on our traditions of military neutrality.
How will it not impinge if we give money to Ukraine? Will the Russians not see that as us even doubling down in our existing support for Ukraine by giving more money, even if we say the money we give goes to the bits of the war effort that doesn't kill people?
Well, look, I mean, the truth is that we have a policy of military neutrality, and that means, and we're very strict on this, we don't participate in military alliances, we don't go into common defence arrangements, we're not in NATO, we're not going to be taking part in any, if there were any European common defence, we wouldn't be taking part in that. And our engagement always at EU level, at international level, has had that as a focus and reflected that. And indeed, when I speak about defence matters at the European table, I always talk about the traditions of various member states needing to be respected. But at the same time, we've never taken a sort of morally neutral or politically neutral approach to the invasion of Ukraine, because it's completely in breach of the principles of the United Nations, in that every country is entitled to its territorial integrity and is entitled to defend that. And that's what Ukraine is doing. And we have given support to that, because that support is necessary for them, but it is also necessary for the wider European continent as well, because it is a major security challenge to all of us.
But given that there is that wider security challenge, does it not imply, and it's been spoken about by many EU countries and by members of the Commission in recent days, that there needs to be a, more of a coming together in relation to defence policy and defence spending? Is that not likely to sweep us up in that, meaning that our military neutrality will be much harder to keep?
I'm not going to say that. I mean, look, there's going to be a European Council this week where the leaders will get together, including the Taoiseach, and decisions will be made on that. And we will. Our traditions of military neutrality will not be affected by that. And the Taoiseach undoubtedly will be emphasising that whatever happens at European level has to reflect that certain member states have different traditions. Notwithstanding that, we are not going to stand in the way of our European colleagues getting together to try to provide what they feel is absolutely necessary in terms of defence for them. I talked to my colleagues in Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Poland, Finland and Sweden. Those countries particularly feel a really serious threat from the Russian Federation in terms of what they've done to Ukraine in terms of a land attack, but also in terms of cyber threats to their governments and their businesses, and also in terms of communication networks and electricity networks as well. And by the way, we in Ireland are not immune from those threats to cyber, as we know that, and indeed, obviously, to our undersea cables and other communications and, you know, electricity connections as well. They're really, really important. And when people talk about defence, yes, they think of traditional military hardware, and lots of countries want to buy that, not to engage in wars. They want to protect themselves and their countries. But there's also computer systems that have to be updated. There's also, you know, navies that have to be updated to make sure that we can protect what is ours. We in Ireland certainly need to protect our undersea cables because, you know, a large part of our economy depends on that connectivity. And we've also got to make sure that we're protecting not just the state against cyber threats, but also the private sector. I mean, every time that there's a cyber attack on the state, you will hear about it. And sometimes they've had, you know, if you look at the HSE, devastating and ongoing consequences. But there's lots of attacks on the private sector we never hear about.
Okay, one final thing I need to ask you about is the reports. Well, Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, Minister for Foreign Affairs, was quite upfront about it in a radio interview yesterday that tomorrow he's bringing to Cabinet proposals in relation to removing the so-called triple lock, that when we send peacekeeping troops to areas of conflict, that it has to be after a decision agreed by the government, the Dáil, and also by the UN Security Council. You want to get rid of the third leg of that, but what do you say to people who believe, particularly the opposition parties, that this will begin the abandonment of our neutrality?
Look, it won't, but I don't think any Irish minister or ambassador or official should be in the position that I was in, and that others have been in as well, when we go to the UN Security Council, and I went in October 22, and one of the functions was to renew the mandate of the peacekeeping mission in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is Operation Althea. I did not know until the last possible moment whether Russia, in that case, would veto our continuing presence in the peacekeeping mission. Now, that mission would have continued without the UN security mandate, but Ireland would have had to withdraw from that. So that would have gone completely against the decision that the Irish government had made and that the Dáil had made, and would simply have been a decision of the government of the Russian Federation. So I was there effectively cap in hand to see would Russia allow us to do this, and that is not sustainable and it is not right. And yes, we absolutely comply with the principles of the UN, and any missions we go on have to have those United Nations principles, territorial integrity, just keeping the peace as our fundamental rocks, as our fundamental basis of our participation. But we cannot be allowing any member, any of the permanent members of the Security Council to dictate or decide what we as a state and our military wish to do in terms of peacekeeping. And that is important to remember. This is about peacekeeping missions. Ireland does not get involved in wars.
Okay.
Get involved in peacekeeping.
Thank you very much, Minister of State Thomas Byrne. Dr. Edward Burke is a lecturer in the history of war at UCD. What do you make of our triple lock? Is it in some respects something that dilutes our national sovereignty if we can't send troops into a peacekeeping zone because we don't have approval from either Russia, China, or indeed the United States?
Yes, I think it does. And I think that this is the right decision because, you know, since the invasion of Crimea, Ukraine in 2014, Russia has gone out of its way to be a spoiler, to be a blocker in the United Nations around new mandates for peacekeeping missions, which has been repeatedly blocked by Russia. So whether it comes to peacekeeping missions in Africa or elsewhere, Russia has decided to punish the European Union, European states and others by preventing any new mandates, even those that are aimed at alleviating the most dire humanitarian situations around the world. So with that, that's completely unacceptable. As a serious country in the business of peacekeeping, in trying to ameliorate, you know, the worst humanitarian crises, we can't simply sit idly and say that, well, because Russia says we can't, no peacekeeping mission will be implemented. This is about, you know, us adhering to, we will always adhere, obviously, to international law, but we need to make our own decisions that are not bound by, you know, completely cynical vetoes from Moscow, Beijing or Washington.
Let's go back to what happened last Friday. Marion McKeown, our US correspondent, joined us for a special at around 6:30 on Friday, and you delivered what I thought was a memorable line, Marion, where you compared the antics of Trump and Vance to that of Tony Soprano and Pauly Walnuts in an episode of The Sopranos. But yet, is there a sense that for many people in the United States of America who don't understand the nuances and details of what is happening in Ukraine, the fact that Ukraine is the country that is the victim of the aggressor Russia, that they'll only see what they saw and will side with their president and vice president?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you could almost compare this to the 2020 election, where a certain significant number of Americans would not be told that the election wasn't stolen. And they are now really, Trump, in his way of repeating things and repeating things and repeating things, which is very deliberate, will get a certain number of people, a significant number, to believe that what he is saying is true by virtue of the number of times he's repeated it. And it's very interesting because over the weekend, I thought there would be more Republican pushback against Trump. And in fact, it really went the other way, that the Republicans on the Hill largely, and he has the State of the Union address tomorrow night, they came out and they doubled down on everything that Trump had said and they applauded him. There were a handful. There was predictably Lisa Murkowski, the Alaskan senator, who has always spoken her mind and who's a moderate. An interesting one was James Langford, who is the Oklahoma senator who got involved in the bipartisan border bill that Trump scuttled. And he pushed back hard against the call for Zelensky to resign, particularly by Lindsey Graham, and said that he shouldn't resign, that that would be really dangerous. And he was very moderate. I'm hearing that behind the scenes, a lot of Republicans are privately appalled by what happened, but I certainly couldn't find anyone to talk to me to say that. So I think that you have a situation where, on the other hand, I think Americans are quite surprised, and possibly Trump, by the welcome that Zelensky got in Europe, by the Ukrainian flag, the Eiffel Tower lit up in the Ukrainian colours, by the 19 leaders who gathered to meet him in London, meeting Prince Charles. That probably didn't go down very well. So I think that there is, but I listened this morning to an interview with Nina Khrushcheva, who is the granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, and she said this: Russia could not in their wildest dreams have dreamed of this happening, because not only does it look like they're going to get to keep what they took from Ukraine, but also that Europe has been broken in the bargain, that the US, UK, the US EU relationship has been smashed in the bargain. She said, Russia, this is beyond their wildest dreams.
One of the things that J.D. Vance attacked Zelensky for was the suggestion that he hadn't said thank you to the United States. Here from NBC are some of the occasions when Zelensky over the years has said thanks to the US, some of them through a translator.
Ukraine is grateful to the United States for its overwhelming support. I came here to the United States to forward the word of thanks to the people of America.
Thank you so much, Mr. President. Thank you for all these 575 days. Yes, and thanks to American people.
I'd like to thank American partners for the support.
Mr. President, thank you, your team. I would also like to thank the United States Congress for their support, both parties, both chambers.
We deeply appreciate that Ukraine and America have stood side by side from the very first moments of this terrible Russian invasion.
There's also, Marion, people, and there's some of them texting in, some of the usual suspects, who are trying to claim that if you look at the entire 50 minutes, you'll see that Zelensky he was the one who agitated, and he was the one who caused Vance and Trump to respond to him, that it was all Zelensky's fault. Again, is that finding favour in the United States, that interpretation of what actually happened?
You know, again, depending on who you talk to, I think there's a very vocal constituency here, including the editorial, scathing editorial from the Wall Street Journal, that really sees this as an ambush, that this was very, very deliberate. And I saw the entire 50 minutes. Now, I would say that one of the things that hasn't been raised and wasn't raised by Zelensky, and it well could have been, was the Budapest Agreement of 1994, where Ukraine, which was the third biggest holder of nuclear arms in the world back then, after the breakdown of the Soviet Union, the Ukraine agreed to give up all of its nuclear weapons in exchange for an agreement with the US, the UK and Russia that if its borders were ever threatened or its sovereignty, that they would come to its rescue. Now, that agreement is still in place, but Russia not only broke that agreement, it smashed it by invading Russia, by invading Ukraine itself. Zelensky could have said, we had an agreement with you back in 1994. You know, he didn't even mention that. And this absurdity about not thanking, you know, apart from the fact that he did, and he thanked America again repeatedly at the cabinet, the bipartisan meeting he had earlier, which was extremely friendly and positive with Republicans and Democrats. He thanked them repeatedly. But what exactly is he supposed to thank Trump for? Because in the 5 weeks Trump has been president, he voted against the resolution at the UN. He's openly sided with Russia. He's called Zelensky a dictator, and he accused him of starting the war. So precisely why should Zelensky be showing Trump specifically and Vance specifically, who made that absurd speech in Europe at Munich? What gratitude does he owe them? I would like to ask in response.
Stay with us, Marion McKeown and Dr. Edward Burke. We'll have Cal Thomas joining us after this.
Have the last word. Text or WhatsApp us on 0874-100-102.
The last word.
With Matt Cooper.
On Today FM.
Cal Thomas, you've had the weekend to think about what you saw in the Oval Office last Friday. What are your opinions on it?
Well, I was shocked, frankly. I've never seen anything like it in over 50 years of covering Washington. I think it was a diplomatic disaster. It was more than manners, I think. It was J.D. Vance, the vice president, who got things going by claiming that Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine had not properly appreciated all that America had done for his country and the aid. That just is flat out false. Zelensky, in numerous occasions before Congress and with individual senators and House members, has thanked the American people over and over again for standing with him and with freedom. Trump and Vance's major problem is they have misdiagnosed what the real issue is. Putin is a relentless thug. He is putting his soldiers into a meat grinder. He has said openly, it's not a secret, that he wants to reclaim the great days of the Soviet Union and re-annex all of those states that were freed when the Berlin Wall came down and communism collapsed. He should be taken at his word. It's not about what this administration does or doesn't do, thinking it will stop Putin from doing what he's doing. It's about standing up to evil. I love what Ronald Reagan said when he was asked by a reporter years ago what his goal was in dealing with the Soviet Union. He responded, "We win, they lose."
Why do you think so that your president, Donald Trump, seems so much in awe of Vladimir Putin, so desperate to tell us about how friendly he is, how well he gets on with him? What's all that about?
Well, he's also praised other dictators, President Xi of China, Kim Jong-un of North Korea. I noticed he hadn't said anything pleasant about the Ayatollahs in Iran, but give him some time. You know, his whole thing is about making a deal. Making a deal is fine, but it's the contents of the deal that's important. If the deal becomes the objective, then you're going to lose to somebody who is a liar and who is a murderer. I met last week with a bunch of Christian ministers from Ukraine who were here in Washington, and they were telling me about the Russian atrocities, kidnapped children being put in so-called orphanages and indoctrinated with Russian propaganda. One of them told me that a group of 140 Ukrainians tried to escape the country. They were caught by Russian forces. Only 12 survived. This is an evil man we're dealing with, and he is not going to be constrained by any niceties that we send his way.
So then, how worried are you that your president and his administration have taken the side of Putin against the Ukrainians?
I'm very concerned about it because this won't be the end of it. I think it was Albert Einstein who said that evil must be resisted or it is going to triumph. This isn't going to be the end of it with Ukraine. If Putin wins, if he maintains the territories that he currently occupies and even more, he's going to go after Latvia and Estonia. What are we going to and those other former Soviet blocs? What are we going to do then? What if he tries to attack Poland and Hungary and those other countries that were part of the Eastern Soviet bloc during the Cold War? What kind of policy is this? We need to know what this this administration's policy is. Right now, it appears to be more appeasement than strength.
And what do you make of all the people around him? For the example, the likes of Marco Rubio, who sat looking absolutely stunned as he watched what was going on, and then, within minutes, was out tweeting, "Thank you, POTUS, for standing up for America in a way that no president has ever had the courage to do before. Thank you for putting America first. America is with you." Is that not Kim Jong-un style levels of sycophancy?
Well, you hit the right word, Matt. It is sycophancy. It is toadyism. I've listened to some of Marco Rubio's speeches when he was a senator on the Senate floor, standing against communism, standing up for freedom in Central and South America and around the world. Very articulate. And now all of these people in the Trump administration think that in the cabinet that the way to win Trump's approval, never mind the best interests of the United States, is just to suck up to him and agree with everything he is doing when previously they might have, and some are on the record of disagreeing with it. It's shocking. It's disturbing. It's dangerous.
Marion, one listener says, Putin via internet bots played a key role in Trump getting the presidency in 2016. That's what Trump owes him. There are other people making allegations about what may have happened because of a Trump visit to Moscow in 1987. Then there are people who are saying that it just comes down to a very simple thing, that he has it in for Zelensky because Zelensky wouldn't help him in relation to the Hunter Biden allegations. What is you think, Marion, at this stage?
Well, you know, I remember Nancy Pelosi standing up in one of her many testy meetings with Trump and pointing her finger at him, saying, "With you, all roads end with Putin. All roads end with Putin." And Hillary Clinton said the same thing again, that, you know, it's absolutely true that he has a lot of animus towards Zelensky because he tried to withhold $400 million worth of military equipment from Zelensky to strong arm him into prosecuting or investigating Hunter Biden, and Zelensky, who was only a couple of months in the job at that stage, refused to do it. And then Trump subsequently got impeached. So absolutely there's animus there. Trump sees Putin as strong. He likes the strong men. It's exactly as Cal just said. But I think also all of this is about making deals. You know, the titanium, lithium, uranium, iron ore, all of these minerals and rare earth stuff that is in Ukraine in abundance, regardless of the logistics of getting to them. Trump wants to sign a deal that will give US really needs access. China has stolen a march on them on accessing the necessary minerals for computers, electric cars, phones, all of these things. And you can be sure Trump is saying, "You let me have Ukraine, I give you a much better deal than Zelensky will ever give you," because that is the way that Trump plays the game. It's you get the best deal, you get the best deal. And I think as well his infatuation with, you know, I don't know what went on in the past. I don't have any facts on it, I don't have any evidence, but we do know because we've seen it at that meeting that Trump had with Putin where he chose his version of events over his own intelligence. We know he's infatuated with and clearly intimidated by Putin. And this fracture in the world order that has existed since 1945 is so dangerous, but in a way it's clarifying. And I think for Zelensky, the reception he got in Europe immediately afterwards and the way that Keir Starmer and Macron and other people spoke, I think shows that Europe has to step up. And it's past time, by the way, that Europe stepped up. But also I think Zelensky did the right thing to stand his ground in the Oval Office, because if you saw the fawning that Macron and Keir Starmer did 2 days previously, they didn't get anything other than not getting kicked out of the Oval Office. They didn't get anything from Trump for all of their fawning and their invitations. You know, so I think it is time that Europe got its act together and really stood up and became a lot more coordinated and a lot firmer and dealt with Trump appropriately, because we are no longer at the moment allies, it seems. America, Trump certainly doesn't see the EU as an ally, nor did he in his first term. And he came out with another tweet this morning saying Zelensky doesn't want there to be peace, criticising Europe as well. And then you saw Pete Hegseth saying that the US is stopping all of its cyber operations against Europe, all the spying against Russia. So this is where we are.
Okay. I want to bring Dr. Edward Burke back in, lecturer in the history of war at UCD. Wars are fought in many ways, aren't they? We have the sort of conventional warfare that we see in Russia's invasion of Ukraine at present and Ukraine's efforts to resist. But could it be that we've been at war for many years, that Russia has been conducting war against Europe, against the United States, against the Western world, using propaganda and disinformation?
Absolutely. We've been in that for years now. And Ireland is no way exempt from that. You know, they are interested in influencing our politics. They are trying to, deliberately sow disinformation. Russia today is interested in sowing disinformation in Ireland. All this state propaganda, whether it's online, whether it's in media, is what, and of course with the European elections as well, there's clear evidence from the European Commission that Russia tried to influence the recent European elections. In terms of hybrid warfare, if you wish, they're involved in sabotage, they're involved in assassination, they've used chemical weapons in EU member states. And this is, they regard themselves as involved in a conflict with the European Union, including Ireland as part of that. So that's something they want to, obviously they're involved in industrial espionage as well, to try and steal dual-use technologies where they can, particularly from weakly protected member states. So it's something which we need to really just realise this, that we are targeted, they're interested in us, and they are sowing disinformation.
But are they winning on the basis that if they separate the United States from the European Union, that they have the potential to run riot? Or how can Europe respond, and how quickly can it do that?
I mean, in the case of Ukraine, it's difficult. It's difficult because, really it would only sort of cost 0.12% of EU GDP to actually fill the gap that would be left by United States withdrawal from military assistance to Ukraine. The problem is that US, we are so dependent upon the US defense industrial sector. So when it comes to things like Patriot missiles, so long-range missile protection, etc., we're not well set up at the moment to deal with that. In the short term, it depends on whether the US is going to also prevent, for example, Patriot missiles from being sent by European donors to Ukraine, whether there's some potential for a landing ground there. But I think when it comes to the medium to long term, there's a lot Europe can do. Europe has very sizable defense spending. In terms of, trying to shift essentially what we have to do is set up a European Defence Union, and that creates complications for Ireland, because for years, the EU single market has exempted defence because a lot of member states, internal market rules have not been applied when it comes to the defence industrial sector, because a lot of member states want to pork barrel their defence spending. It's not efficient. They want to basically fuel domestic spending and domestic industry. And so therefore joint procurement doesn't happen. Efficiency is sometimes sacrificed for pork barrel politics.
And was it also not due to the fact that some member states were also militarily neutral, albeit fewer now than used to be?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really have much of a defence sector to talk about, so that hasn't really been, that's why we need to go to the US to buy things and elsewhere, is that, we don't really, unlike, let's say, a country like Sweden, which was, aligned for a long time, not neutral, and then recently joined NATO. We don't have much of a defence sector to speak about, so we'll always have to go to NATO countries, particularly to spend our defence money. I think that's short-sighted. I think that should change. We have also clear advantages when it comes to drone technology, satellites, innovation and research that we do here in this country. There's lots of things we could do for Ukraine, indeed for European defence. We haven't really incentivized our defence market yet, or defence sector in this country, to do that. I think that might change. I think we're going to see a really substantial increase in defence spending by the EU. Macron is talking about using the European Stability Fund. He's also talking about common borrowing. I don't think he wants Ireland to exempt itself from that. So we're going to be in really tricky territory in terms of, you know, us standing up, as the Minister said earlier, and saying that, no, we want out of X, Y and Z. There's not a lot of patience or bandwidth for that. The situation is extraordinarily urgent. It's not negotiations over the Lisbon Treaty 15 years ago. Europe doesn't have the time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Edward Burke. Marion McKeown, Cal Thomas, thank you for being with us. We will have our normal American spot tomorrow and we will give it plenty of time. There are some people getting in touch saying Trump is only looking to stop war. Russia is willing to talk with him to stop war. Well, if Russia was keen to stop war, if it's as innocent as some of the text messages I'm getting would suggest, well, why doesn't Russia stop its invasion of Ukraine? Why doesn't Russia surrender the land that it has stolen from Ukraine? There's one very easy way for this whole war to stop. It's Russia stopping it. It's not about putting the burden on Ukraine.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.